Yes. You're about to hear one of the most provocative partnerships in rock, performing a big hurt from their current LP, Tin Machine 2. This is Reeves Gabrels, Hunt, and Tony Sales with David Bowie, otherwise known as Tin Machine.
Hello, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's wonderful to be back with you with this, the second part of my conversation with author, musician, professor, and all-round superstar Leah Cardos on Tin Machine 2, the overlooked, underrated work from 1991. So underrated, in fact, it's not even properly available, which is a mystery in itself. A rumoured Tin Machine box set sometimes seems to float up on social media that it's imminent, but then it never quite happens. So we feel that this is a great tragedy, as to ignore Tin Machine, to write off that whole project, is to really ignore a crucial, transformative and vital moment in Bowie's evolution. But while Tin Machine 2 is often passed off as yet another misfire in a period where poor old Bowie couldn't seem to catch a commercial or critical break, we feel there's some inspired songwriting and brilliant performances on this album, which, under different circumstances, would be standout moments in the Bowie canon. Oh, well, yes, there is Stateside and Sorry 2, but, well, this is Tin Machine 2. So anyway, stand back, relax, and I hope you enjoy. I want to read you something which I found on bowiebible.com. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but let me know if you have. This is what it says. I direct that my executor shall arrange for my remains to be taken to the country of Bali and to be cremated there in accordance with the Buddhist rituals of Bali. If that is not practical, then I direct my executor shall arrange for my remains to be cremated and my ashes scattered in Bali. The will of David Bowie.
Dream of Amlapura.
Yeah.
That fact does, I think, make a lot of us go back to this song again and listen to it a little bit differently.
Hey, hey, it's the tossing on a beam reach for Java. Make way for the Java, watching for boobies. Dreaming, I would burn you if you should die. Hey, hey, I would burn you.
It's criminal that this is not on streaming. I'm annoyed that I can't put this on a playlist on Spotify or Apple Music, because it's just loveliness. It's lovely. It's classic. It's exquisite. It's one of the best songs he ever wrote in my book.
Really?
It's, yes. It's stunning. It's dreamy and mysterious. It's one of Bowie's more numinous compositions. I use the word numinous specifically. Numinous in the way that, like, you know, that kind of magical sense that something turns around and recognizes you back. Like, you might look at the stars or the moon and you can see it nodding back at you or beckoning you. This is a song that beckons. It's a song that looks back at you, listens back to you and beckons, I think. It's just gorgeous. And I think the band sound fantastic here. I think the band actually brings something to this song that I don't think I'm sure it would have been a gorgeous song no matter how Bowie would have realized it. But I think this version of it, with Hunt's drumming in particular, really sensitive and really beautiful, and the guitar work, all that layered acoustic.
Yeah.
And I think Kevin Armstrong's on this too.
He is, yes.
It's gorgeousness, just clusters of gorgeousness, all of those chords, you know. Just beautiful.
It's incredibly evocative. I only found that quote recently, but I've always loved this song. I mean, you put it beautifully about its numinous property. To me, it's just redolent of that atmosphere. You know, you feel like you're in that climate, in that place. Yet again, I go back to Tonight, but on Tonight we have almost like the flip side of this, Tumble and Twirl.
Yeah, that song.
I like it. I've really grown to like it. But this is that's a song kind of bewailing the commodification of the islands as a sort of tourist package destination. And here you get why it's so important. It comes across so beautifully in this.
And the sort of the kind of the tragic imagery of the volcano and the aftermath of the people that suffered there, and this idea of, you know, bodies being buried, children standing up, and then just, you know, the imagery of someone burning. And he says, you know, hey, hey, it's a dreaming.
Yeah.
I would burn you if you should die. Hey, hey, I would burn too. And it's just, what a beautiful lyric. And I think as well, you know, just the way that the guitar is, this kind of 12-string sort of quality. I'm not sure if it was a 12-string or just three acoustic guitars layered up. But they're kind of cloudy chord, this kind of mysterious sonority, reminds me of the beginning strums of Space Oddity, that kind of weird C major chord that's not quite an E minor chord. You know, that thing happening again where you're not sure what the actual chord is being played, and what it is like maybe layers of performances playing different chords, creating this like cluster of sound. But it also reminds me of that really mysterious chord at the beginning of Starman. It's like, to me it suggests mystery, you know, and this kind of magic, kind of weird.
Oh, that's
sort of
interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
An entrancement. It's like a strange, uncanny sort of quality where maybe magic is possible, you know. And
that's interesting you say. I always think of the beginning of Signet Committee.
Yeah, that too.
You know, that sort of strange, rather questioning, hesitant
chord. It's like, what is this chord? What's going on? Is it happy or sad? Or is it, you know, dark or light? What, you know, it's just this kind of blurry. Bowie's quite good at writing that sort of thing. But I think what's going on this record is like people playing chords, different chords on top of each other to create these really lovely clusters.
It's a beautiful texture, isn't it?
His melody as well.
Well, the melody is gorgeous. There's a lovely quote here from Tim Palmer about the vocal. When he sang Amlapura, one of my favourite tracks, he came in, had a listen, and decided he would sing it again. Everybody wanted to know why he wanted to do it again, because it was so good and so well performed. But he said that he felt the vocal could be sadder. The way he went about doing that is that he sang the vocals slightly flatter, and he sang it first time. To have that control is just something I've never experienced before. To this day, I've never heard of anyone being able to do that. But he could do it. He was that good.
Yeah.
Just imagine doing a take of that and then going, you know what? No, I can get it even sadder. I want it.
Yeah.
There's a sad, there's, you know, reaching deep inside himself for something here.
Yeah. But also just shows knowledge of his mode of expression, you know, his ability as a recording artist to use his voice like colour on this song. It's just the melody as well. It just sits so exquisitely just beyond resolution. You know, it kind of just trails off, but it doesn't end anywhere. It just sort of sits just above or below. He caps his hey, hey, or the hey, hey. Like they come up and go, and there's structure to it. Whenever there's repetition, there's always elaboration. It's just such an example of Bowie sort of firing on all cylinders as a songwriter, you know, even in this uncertain period where he's trying to find his feet again. You know, you can really hear, I think, the beginnings of like the kind of, you know, deep, almost spiritual longing in his songwriting that you hear later on Heathen and again, you know, on Black Star, sort of emerging here.
This is something that has been overlooked with Tin Machine 2.
This is not Brat, this one.
This is not Brat.
And I'm going to come out and say that, like, this song and Mr. Ed, to me, elevate this album in the 90s catalogue by dint of being here, because I think they're two of his best songs.
Absolutely.
And it's criminal that they're not available, or, you know, something needs to happen.
I think we need to get the campaigner for this to be re-released.
I think so. Let's do it, Arsalan.
Let's form a record label.
Let's write a letter.
Let's write a very stiff letter on cardboard. So, I don't know. I don't know who we'd have to write a letter to.
It's a good factoid about this song is that it's one of two songs that he sung in Indonesian.
Yes. Didn't that come out as a B-side or something?
It was a B-side to Baby Universal, I want to say.
Right.
Down.
think it's beautiful. It's much better than Never Let Me Down. No, Don't Let Me Down and Down and Down, which is the other one that he did in Indonesian.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh my God, no, I've never heard. I didn't even know that existed.
You don't need to check it out.
So from the sublime to the less sublime, Betty Wrong.
Betty Wrong.
First released on the soundtrack of the 1990 film The Crossing.
Australian movie.
Is it?
I think so. It had Russell Crowe in it anyway. Okay, so that makes it an Australian movie.
Okay, it's definitely Australian. Betty Wrong was first released on the soundtrack of the 1990 film The Crossing and was remixed the following year for the second Timochine album. What is The Crossing? Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay. So even though it's got Russell Crowe in it.
Yeah.
As a fully paid up Australian.
I know. I had to hand my Australian card in.
I haven't seen it either, so I don't know. Let me just quote Reeves first. I put a lot of effort into that record. A song like Betty Wrong has a lot of harmonic development in it. Hmm. End quote.
Okay. Well, look, it's got a lot of hooks in it, and it's got a lot of sax. The chorus is on a different planet to the verse. The verse sounds like Wishful Beginnings from One Outside. He sounds like a creepy malingerer. And then in the chorus, it's like, la, 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 whoa, it's really different. And then the song just kind of chops between the two.
It is
like a collage.
It is a weird thing, isn't it? I mean, the chorus to me, I can, having not seen The Crossing, but you can imagine the chorus being in a film. You know, it's got that.
Yeah.
Ah, da, 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 da.
Whoa, yeah.
So Otto actually started whining when I started
singing. He liked
singing
to sing it as well. What's he sung it with you.
I know what you mean. I do actually quite that slightly Beatly background. La, la, la. You know, it's it's not very Tin Machine.
Yeah. It just feels like a bit of a Frankenstein song. Mm. Like, it reminds me a little bit of the, you know, the Next Day ones that are maybe on the extra or something. They just felt a bit like sketches. It just feels like a sketch of a song. I mean, what's it about anyway?
I don't know.
Is it about possession?
Bowie Bible had a theory that it was about an old R&B singer called Betty Wright.
Huh.
Or inspired by the single Betty Wright. I don't know. I mean, it's pure speculation. I have no idea what it's about. I don't have... Let me have a look at the lyrics, actually.
The lyrics are kind of dark, I think. There's a song like with the kiss of the comb at the end.
The kiss of... Sorry?
The last line of the song. When the kiss of the comb, or something like that.
I don't know. After the sessions, the band went on temporary hiatus while Bowie appeared in the Linguini incident and prepared for the Sound Vision tour. I guess this was recorded quite early on. In his absence, Reeves continued to work on the session recordings. So this was really a Reeves jam.
It's a Reeves number.
A Reeves number, exactly. All right, so here's what they're saying. Betty Wright, an American soul and R&B singer who, like Bowie, found fame in the 70s. She rose to fame in the 70s with hits such as Clean Up Woman and Tonight Is the Night. Why would he be writing a song all about her? I don't know.
Yeah, so the last line of it is, when the kiss of the comb tears my face, which puts me in a kind of place, like, psychologically. But then it's like, da 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 da. Da, 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 da. And it's like, that to me is not the spirit of, you know, every lamb ceases to graze. All these like verses are super creepy.
These are very Black Star lyrics, aren't they?
Tears my face from the bone. Yeah. I mean, so I'm feeling some kind of way in the verses. And he's doing the super creepy, like, you know, Wishful Beginnings voice, like I'm a serial killer voice from One Outside.
Oh, yes.
And then it just bursts into Technicolor happiness in the choruses. That's the problem I have with this song.
I was caught from ahead, nurtured on grime, goodwill and screams. Now your breath fills my step. Now there is you till life is gone. But I'll be your light when the shadows fall down the walls.
La, la, la. Yeah. Whoa.
Then life will be done and yeah. It just won't matter at all. Boom. So this is the first verse. Till the sun blisters and sprays and every lamb ceases to graze. When the kiss of the comb tears my face from the bone. I'll be your light when the shadows fall down the walls.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
That's, we should do a cover of this. Let's do a cover of this.
I think we could do a good interpretation of this one.
Yeah. Okay, I'm looking on a website, a song.
Doesn't hang together for me. That's the storyline I'm trying to say.
I just want to come back at you with, I'm on songmeanings.com and I've just looked up the lyrics. And there's a comment dated 16 years ago by somebody called Cute Sparkina. And Cute, he or she writes, "Methinks Mr. Bowie is singing about love in times of nuclear war. The images, till the sun blisters and sprays, and every lamb ceases to graze. When the kiss of the comb tears my face from the bone, all suggests the effects of a nuclear catastrophe. Huh. The gentleman is saying to the lady in his life that he will love her until a nuclear disaster wipes out all life, including the lives of him and his sweetheart."
So where does Betty Wright come into that?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is it Time Will Crawl Part 2? I don't know.
I think you're right, though. It is a Frankenstein of a song.
I think it's a Frankenstein song.
It really
I think
is,
they had bits
it?
And pieces lying around.
Yeah.
And they smushed them together.
So Reeves would have been, you know, working away on this stuff while he was off doing Linguini Incident or Sound and Vision, whatever. And then he goes, all right, David, here's what I've got. Oh, I've had to put that bit here and then put, you know, that thing you got about the lambs? Can we get that in somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get the lambs in there somewhere.
I know people like love this song.
Really?
Like,
who loves it?
Well, I say people. I went and had a look on pushing Ahead of the Dame and looked at the comments section. And, you know, because at the time when Chris was writing the blog about Tin Machine 2, he was pretty negative about it. There's a lot of fans were coming into the comments and saying, hang on, I like this song. And a lot of people were saying they like this.
I haven't looked at Chris's blog for Tin Machine 2. I do look at Chris. I mean, I really enjoy Chris's
blog. It's like a time capsule.
It is, and I really enjoy it. And I found that when I look at it ahead of doing episodes, I tend to just start quoting him nonstop, which is very unfair on poor old Chris. But I do like the comments he gets.
Well, it's good as well because these comments were done, you know, years before David died. And so all the revisionist emotions that come to like, oh, everything he did is brilliant, it's untouched by that, you know. More or less. There are people coming in, I think, when Amlapura to, you know, put the little bit in about, oh, this, clearly this is a really important song for David. But yeah, it's like a little, you know, just before Bowie was cool again, before the next day was even announced, back in the old darkness of the new millennium, people were talking about Tin Machine in this way. I just find it's interesting.
That revisionism, especially after an artist passes away, is kind of intriguing from a critical point of view because it does make, it is important to acknowledge the flops, the misfires.
Yeah, you got it.
The things that didn't work out.
As
celebrating the big successes.
You know? Well, I also think that you do an artist like David Bowie a disservice if you don't critique the failures, because the failures are so important on the journey towards his artistry. You know, it's the times that he didn't hit it, to me, are really interesting. Like the work he was doing in the 60s, trying to find his feet, you know, the stuff in the 80s, this whole period right here. So I find it so fascinating because something happened in all of this mess, in all of this swirl, something happened where he really found something to hang on to, which led him out of this into, you know, some of his later masterpieces like One Outside, you know, and Heathen. And this is where he finds his feet for that stuff. This uncertainty. And also around, you know, in a few years' time, he's like doing the EPK for One Outside and talking about artistry and saying, if you can't quite find your feet, then you're in the right spot. You know, so he's talking about uncertainty and risk, but with some genuine authority and, you know, some proper knowledge, because he's just been through that.
Because it was pretty much an experiment in its own way, in its own nature. I think a Tin Machine probably embodies some of the best and some of the worst. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. So of the work that I've done over the last 10 years anyway, it had extraordinary high points and some real downers. Which comes with the territory of experimentation. Not all of it works, but when it does work, it works really well.
He's talking about that a lot around the time of Outside, just because Outside was such a left turn. But here what we're seeing, I think, is that in action, isn't it? We're seeing that experimentalism happening. And, you know, he's kind of staked the farm, really, on Tin Machine here. Like we were saying, the record label.
Taking big risks. With his reputation.
But again, the reputation was a weird one at that point, wasn't it? The reputation was pretty much in the toilet. I mean, the fact that a melody maker journalist felt that they had the ability to write what they wrote indicates kind of where he was critically. I mean, could you imagine today?
You can't imagine it. But it wasn't just here. It was all through the 90s. I mean, all the way up to all the drum and bass stuff with Earthling and even Hours. I mean, British press were just so rude to him throughout the whole Britpop time, where he seemed like he was out of touch, even though Suede were doing what Bowie, you know, basically Suede were doing a Bowie and they were okay. But he was really derided in the press.
He got flack, but don't forget things like Bowie and Brett on the NME. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
And that was quite nice. I mean, that was obviously before, you know, the really big toxicity of the whole Britpop nonsense.
And there was also that Brit Awards moment where he came out looking like Sean Bean, right, with the fresh face. Remember that?
I don't remember that.
And he played with Placebo. Do you remember that?
Oh, no, I remember him playing with Placebo. I'm just trying to imagine Sean Bean wearing high heels playing with Placebo, and I'm failing dramatically to do it. He looked like Sean Bean, really? I can't remember what he looked like for that. I mean, I remember the gig. Did they do 20th Century Boy, right?
Yeah.
Sean Bean? Really?
That's what I remember.
It's not another dream you had, is it?
Could have been.
Okay. Right. okay. So
Betty
next,
Wrong.
Next. So that's Betty Wrong. We still don't know where that title comes from. This is an interesting one. Over, under, out. You can't see me coming. You can't talk. I don't see you swimming.
Four-way songwriting credit, the only one on the album.
It kind of figures it's that confusing.
I think this is the funniest song on the album.
Okay. Whatever adjective you're going to come up with, I wasn't prepared for funniest, but
it's so funny.
Go for it.
No, it just is. Like, just straight out the gate, that weird kind of, this weird sort of rhythm. And then he comes out saying, like, you know, beasts in booties, looking at, and it's like this crazy, like, what is he singing? It's
Beauty
mad.
Streets, beast in booties.
What is he singing? And then, so there's like, that crazy verse. And then the chorus comes in. You can talk. Da, 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 da. It sounds like Chili Down from Labyrinth soundtrack.
Yes.
It sounds
There's
like
definitely
those weird
a Chili Down vibe. Yes,
puppets with the red heads that pop off. That's what it sounds like.
It's kind of it follows on from Betty Wrong
song.
In the sense that the verse and the chorus
could
well be, you know, Frankensteined in from different songs, because it starts off and there's a distinct air, and I'm not sure if it's intentional. You know, the first line, beauty shrieks, beast in the booties.
Beast in booties.
And it sounds like Frit on Heroes.
Yeah,
you've got Reeves doing really itchy, intense guitar. And
it's demented. The whole thing is demented.
Batshit crazy, isn't it?
It's batshit. But then, like, the chorus sounds like some kind of cheesy shit that you would hear on Never Let Me Down or something. Like, it's got a pop, it's got a weird pop, COD Caribbean, like, you know?
Are you hearing...
The way he sings it.
Are you hearing white reggae here? Because this is something
I am
that,
a little bit.
Yeah. This is something that we got a lot on tonight, was the white reggae, the, you know, don't look down.
Yes.
And, of course, you know who the man was behind that, Hugh Padgham, who had previously been working with the police.
Are you saying
on
it's...
Synchronicity. So maybe... Padgham
maybe he's coaching them to get rid of their diphthongs.
Yes. It could be sort of, hey, guys, well, you know what? I've been hanging out with Sting recently and...
He doesn't like a diphthong.
He does not like a diphthong. No. So it could be that. But, again, it's funny, isn't it? This is a classic case of Tin Machine patching together. And I think very much by dint of its... birth and its gestation.
It's four-way credit means that everyone has this little stake in the song and they've put in... Like, I think the chorus is pure Bowie. No one else could write that. And I think the verse is probably like Tony coming up with that crazy bass line.
Yeah.
And then there's that weird bridge where it goes... Jugga, 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 jugga. I think maybe that's Reeves. No, they all just got 25% of the riches that came in.
There is a lot going on here, though. I mean, there are echoes of, say, something like African Night Flights in the way he's doing that kind of like machine gun sort of delivery.
It's a look at you. It's that note there that makes me laugh. Yeah. It's so funny. I can't not crack a smile when I hear him sing that because that is just the most demented thing ever. It's a word salad and then he's just delivering the odd word. It's amazing Bowieism.
I'm gonna have to go back and listen to it with that in mind because I hadn't picked up on that. I was listening to this trying to figure out what's the point of this.
Yeah.
And
what's it doing?
Why is it here? What's it doing? I don't really like it that much. But then it's got definitely it's got a touch of Heroes in Reeves's, you know, maniacal guitar. Mm. And I also then, like we were saying, it's also got a bit of African Night Flight. And then in his stuttering, staggering machine gun delivery. You've got a bit of Earthling, maybe, pre-shadowing what he's going to be doing there.
It's a bit of a barrage of stuff. Yeah. But then that poppy chorus. It's Chilly Down. It's just Chilly Down.
Like the man said, don't lose your head.
When you think it's wild, chilly down with the bargain.
Hey, I know what I
do. Tall with the bargain.
Well, it could be worse. It could be.
Oh no. Oh no. Now, if there's ever a song on here that, I mean, okay, so One Shot would be like a stripper. Mm-hmm. Like, this is like.
What is this then?
A truck stop cheap petrol station trip stripper. This is like.
A stripper who's seen better days.
This is like.
It's just down on her
low
luck.
Rent. This is a cheap establishment.
I don't think you even come close, to be honest.
This is Roadhouse, straight up rhythm and blues Dodge.
She missed me and all the fun we've had. I think it'd be the best way. She said she missed me every way. So
no holding back, I'm going home. No holding back, I'm going home. I'm going stateside.
So stateside. Now, there's a quote somewhere from Bowie talking about this song, and God knows what his innermost feelings were about having to give not one but two vocals to Hunt Sales. We might never know what went on behind the scenes to occasion this, but he talks with respect and politeness about Hunt's contributions, which... You said at the beginning you see Tin Machine as being very much part of the Bowie canon. So in a way, these are David Bowie songs. These are songs in the Bowie canon.
I think that they're debatable.
Legally.
I think they're debatable.
Legally, these are...
I'm ready to disown them is what I'm saying.
These are David Bowie songs.
I could lose them.
Well, it's strange.
It's because it's shit.
But it is... Okay, we should just clarify. I think you and I are united on the fact that it's shit.
It's shit.
But how did it get from Shitsville to recorded and released?
This is why we need Reeves here to explain, because it makes no sense. I think I think Hunt is decent singer. He's got like a kind of bluesy voice. It's not offensive. Like, I mean, the song is offensive, but his voice is not offensive. It's just when you've just listened to like seven songs with Bowie going full throttle, considering that you can't talk, the craziness of that, to then just go to this mid hetero normal bullshit, like Roadhouse, cheap stripper music. It's just, it's too much. It's just, there's no art to it. There's no artifice to it. And so straight away he loses out because of just the juxtaposition of the vocalism. It isn't there. But then the song is, you know, would it be better if Bowie sang it? Maybe. But not much.
Do you hear him, do you discern him on the backing, on the chorus? I mean, as a...
What, the, the bridge?
I'm going up.
Oh, and the Maryland, you know, all that stuff. That weird bridge that he has.
Yeah. You, you kind of hear him there, don't you?
You do.
Yeah.
It doesn't redeem it for me. But look, the thing this song has got going for it is that it's not as bad as Sorry.
It's not Sorry. That's what we can say for it.
Yeah, it's not Sorry, and that's something that it has going for it. And also, I mean, there's a solo break, a really greedy, savage guitar flash of something interesting. It's kind of fevered that comes in, and it's like, what is this? And then it's gone, and then you're back to the da-da-da-da-da. And you're like, no, this is not what I want. I want some craziness, like at least chop in something that I can hang on to. Bowie does a solo on the saxophone, which is like, I don't even know if it's in the same key. Like maybe he was trying to do something artful, like by doing that, you know, ooh, the songs on Tin Machine are interesting harmonically and people are playing in different keys. So maybe he tried to do a solo in the wrong key. It just sounds like a mistake. And it's just really sad.
I did wonder if that was a desperate attempt to bring another dimension to it.
Some avant-garde, just chuck some avant-garde on it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense.
Because I remember when I was about 15, 16, you go around your friend's house and everyone had their cheap guitars and you kind of painstakingly learn a plodding blues progression, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, that's what this is. I mean, it's almost like a situationist prank in the sense that it's so banal that it's here. Do you know what I mean? It's almost like a gag, a joke. It's so bad. And I think I could push that theory if it were not for the fact that it's the longest song on the album.
They've
done it live. And it just keeps going. So if it was like an art prank, you'd think it would have its one outing and that'd be it. But no.
Well, I'm trying to put it in the context of its time. Like, was there a sort of valorization of that kind of dumb blues?
No.
Bluesy hard rock? I'm thinking.
I don't think so.
Wasn't there like a Stevie Ray Vaughan Double Trouble? There was
that was in the late 80s,
wasn't it?
Yeah, that was mid. I mean, he was hot post Let's Dance, wasn't he? Mid 80s. But again, that wasn't turgid like this.
Turgid is the word.
Look, we've just been talking about the harmonics and dynamics and various properties of You Belong in Rock and Roll.
And Amlapura.
And Amlapura, the heartbreaking, Universal. Exquisite songwriting of Amlapura.
Yes. Yeah.
This is something that they might play at, you know, 10 in the morning when they arrive at the studio just to warm up.
Yeah. Maybe they wrote it for their fans so their fans could go to the bar and have a wee. You know,
that would be very considerate. Yeah, that's why it goes on for so long.
Thing to do, yeah. Everyone needs to go out and have a fag and have a wee and get a drink, and then they come back stateside's just finishing up.
Can you see a world where Tony Sales would submit a song and the rest of the guys said, "Nah, it's no stateside, is it?"
Possibilities are out there.
This, and you know, weirdly, this is a Bowie Sales co-write.
Because I think Bowie wrote The Bridge with the Marilyn Monroe line and the Kennedy whatever.
Yeah. It sounds like him.
It does sound like him. And the verse doesn't sound like him. The chorus doesn't sound like him.
The verse does not sound like him.
It could have been the case that like Bowie was absent and it was just the three of them working on songs, and then Bowie would come in and just like contribute the chorus to You Can't Talk or the verse to Betty Wrong or the bridge to this, and then they left all these pieces and they're like, they're the ones doing the work. So maybe, you know, how involved was he at this point if he's doing the Linguini incident and he's doing a tour and he's just met Iman and he's, you know, like he's probably not super present as a quarter of Tin Machine during this time.
I guess so. And then you take away If There Is Something, which they exhumed from the first album sessions, you take away this and Sorry. And that's like a good, it's not an overlong album, is it?
You know,
that's not a much good there, chunk really. Of the album gone.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So that's a good point, actually. Well, we probably spent longer talking about Stateside in the last 10 minutes than people have in the last 10 years. So, you know, fair play.
Stateside discourse. Bring it back.
So let's move on. Let's move on to the next song.
Small black someone jumps over the crazy white guard, cranking up the volume of a Michael Jackson song. Between the dull cold eyes and the mind unstable, no one over here reads the papers proud. Between the dull cold eyes and the mind unstable, he's a clean trick and he's shopping for girls.
It's tough. God. Tough
this
subject.
It is tough, isn't it?
Yeah. Wasn't the story behind this, it was Reeves' wife was a journalist that did an article on the...
Oh, really?
The child prostitution in Thailand, which was horrendous and disgusting expose, but like there's a connection with Reeves there. It's a little bit different from Tin Machine 1 where it feels like there's a bit of more moralizing going on and a bit of shouting and at injustice, and it's much more political, Tin Machine 1. This one feels more morally ambiguous in the sense that not just the bratish behavior going on, but this sort of disassociative, sort of dispassionate kind of reportage on atrocity, which is something that feels a bit the next day to me in the sense of that really? Vocal quality that he adopts. Yeah, it's kind of this disassociated, unemotional way that he reports on terrible things in his songs that I think actually adds a poetic quality to it. You know, it creates a kind of weird...
I know what you mean, yeah.
Almost dark almost mirror sort of stuff. Like this kind of, like, understand that this is you. Understand that this could be you. Really dark. Bowie's voice brings that out, but also the lyrical stance of just describing things in this kind of blank voice. It's horrific. And I think it's fantastic in that way, if you listen to it in that way, because it also just sort of hits you with just its absurdity, you know, as well. Like, what is this song? What is he singing about? What? Yeah. You know,
this is the kind of thing he was doing a lot around Never Let Me Down, wasn't it? You know, he was very taken. And to be fair, this was something that a lot of, you know, wealthy rock stars were doing in the late 80s. You know, sort
They were all appalled, weren't they?
They were all appalled. Exactly. Yeah. I think it's a post Live Aid thing, but it was kind of like, you know, social consciences were awakened left, right and centre. And it's not facile. I'm not putting it down and saying it's facile. You know, you can't help but be affected by the narrative. I think it's Bowie as a vignette writer, which he's wonderful at.
Really?
And here he does it, you know, like he zones in on these tiny details, scrawny limbs and toothy grins and, you know, the client, you know, he conveys the...
The clean rag doll at the end is just so appalling and disgusting. It is horrible. Detail. But there's something that, you know, that Bowie, I mean, is it 100% successful? I'm not sure. Because the song, I don't know if people engage with it on the level that he's asking you to with it, you know, it's not like he's making any kind of moral commentary on it. He's just telling you this exists and isn't it something. And he makes you languish in its disgustingness. Like he lets you sit with it, you know, and he puts it, he reflects it back at you and he makes you sit with it. And he's got a couple songs like that. It reminds me of some of the stuff he does on One Outside and The Next Day, where he reflects back something really ugly and he makes you sit there and contemplate it.
It's interesting you bring up One Outside a lot when we've been talking today. Yeah. There seems to be a lot of the things you've been saying, there seems to be a lot of parallels. And I think that's, again, you know, he's making this album, he's all over the place, but ideas are beginning to crystallize, you know, like deeper concepts are beginning to crystallize. And of course, that's something that's going to become very much dominant in his mind once he's got Outside out of the way. Sorry, not Outside. Once he's got Black Tie, White Noise done, you know, he's going hell for leather for that.
Yeah, I certainly feel a lot of the building blocks of what will become One Outside. I can sense them here, not just in the songwriting lyrically, but in the weird, you know, murky production, the sort of atmospherics, the use of sonics, and also the use of his voice to characterize different stances, different perspectives or emotions. And this impressionistic, amoral, slightly sociopathic, slightly morally dubious lyrical position that he comes from, to me, does signal that One Outside storyteller.
Yes.
You know, who is also sociopathic.
The classic unreliable narrator.
Yes.
Yes.
And also the confronting of evil with the sort of the banal, you know, the banality of evil.
But here that distinction is very clearly drawn, isn't it? I mean, here he's unquestionable in his position.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't get into that ambiguity that there is with Outside.
No. Is it art? Question mark. Yeah, no, we don't get that here.
There's no Algeria touchscreen here.
No.
I remember when I was doing that episode with Nick Pegg, I kept calling it Algeria touchscreen. Touchscreen.
Touchscreen.
Touchscreen. Algeria touchscreen. And poor old Nick was getting increasingly vexed. just before we leave Shopping for Girls, is there anything you'd like to say?
I think the chorus is really good.
Yeah.
It's a good chorus.
The mind are unstable.
Yeah, with the backing vocals, like the stacked vocals. I think it's a good chorus.
I'm amazed that this just got so panned, this album.
But also the production quality of this one, to me, feels similar to not One Shot, You Belong in Rock and Roll. Yes. It has that atmospheric spaciousness, which you don't really get in a Tin Machine song very often. And this and You Belong in Rock and Roll, to me, feel like sort of sister productions. Like, they kind of talk to each other on either side of the record.
Kevin Armstrong did piano on this. There's a 1996 version, which I didn't know.
There was an acoustic version of this that came out on the Changes Now Bowie compilation. I know it's hard to keep track of all these compilations, my God. But there's an amazing acoustic version, and I think Reeves or somebody, I think it's Reeves, playing slide guitar.
As he lies on a mattress in a rat-infested room, talking about his family and the cold back home. Between the dull, cold eyes and the mind unstable, no one over here reads the papers, pal. Between the dull, cold eyes and the mind unstable, he's a clean trick and he's shopping for girls.
And it does change the song a little bit in a good way. Like, it adds another layer to it. Makes it foregrounds the lyric more. I would say that
he did a similar thing with "Loving the Alien," where he performed it just with Jerry. I think this was around the Reality time, just him and Jerry playing acoustic. And he does go back, like we were saying earlier on with "Baby Universal," he does go back to these songs that he feels there's something there that was missed the first time around. And of course, these songs stand up on their own.
Yeah, they do.
They're so well done. I'm also surprised to find out that this was another outtake from the first album.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know either. That's an interview that Tim Palmer gave, that this was an outtake from Tin Machine 1. Now, you can't imagine, again, that
kind of... It would have been angry on Tin Machine 1.
It would have been
moralising, wouldn't it?
It was like what I was saying earlier about Under the God. It would have been that sort of hectoring, finger-wagging, demonic preacher voice.
Yeah, bellowing, "You're shopping for girls, they're shopping for girls." It would have been...
You make him sound like Anthony Newley. "They're shopping for girls, they're shopping for girls." Like,
I'd like to hear that version of the song.
Okay, well, that's another cover we'll have to do. I've just found here on the Bowie Bible a quote. "Shopping for Girls is about child prostitution in North Thailand. Reeves's wife did a story on it. The story came about because we were talking about it one evening. I'd been to Thailand and I witnessed the same sort of thing going on. Approaching that as a subject was pretty hard because one didn't want to make it a sensational kind of thing. It was hard to stop it being a finger-wagging song, so it ended up as a pure narrative. That speaks very much to what you were saying now.
That's about what we were the, just talking the, about. Yeah, the, it would have felt finger-waggy if it was on Tin Machine 1.
Yeah. Oh, finger waggy, finger smack, you know, fist smashing. Yeah.
Fisty smashy.
But we're going from finger waggy to fisty smashy. But he would have had to forego any nuance or any kind of internal dynamics just to make it a sledgehammer pile driving, you know, 20-minute hunt. Clattering drums at the end. Okay, so
brute force is not what he needs.
It's not, is it? But for the next song, is it what we need?
You know, this was going to be the title of the whole album, I read somewhere.
Really?
Yeah, I read that this was going to be the title. The Four Statues and Big Hurt. That's what I read.
Well, it's been described as a priapic cock rocker.
Priapic.
So, a priapic cock rocker. So another theme which has been popping up, so to speak, throughout our discussion on this album. Re-emerges here.
But Bowie wrote this alone. This is a single David Bowie credit.
Isn't that remarkable? This is the only solo Bowie
sounds like
composition.
It sounds like David sat down and was like trying very hard to write a Pixies song.
Yes, he was well into the Pixies at the time, wasn't he?
And he's trying to sing like Black Francis. He's trying.
I hadn't discerned that.
The way that he sings, you know, I know, all that the ranting and raving over the verse, and even the chorus, you know, oh, the big hurt, the kiss it for me, woo, all that stuff. That to me feels very much like stream of consciousness, avant-garde, Black Francis kind of delivery and lyrics, and this pig squealing sort of.
hang on a second. I'm just going to remind myself of this. You're right. This is very Pixies.
Very Pixies.
I get it, yeah. He's talking a few months later after the release of the album when a journalist says, well, hey, didn't do so well with that, did you? And he responds quite angrily and says, you know, the record label did dick for the promotion. I mean, those were his words. I remember thinking, what a strange term, what a strange thing to say. He said, we got dick in terms of record label promotion, but... doesn't matter. The bands we like the Pixies, they don't sell records either.
Yeah.
So this was definitely... And he remained a Pixies, big Pixies fan.
Die hard years, didn't he? Pixies fan, yes.
Absolutely. But this has got all the Pixies stuff going on.
It's like Pixies by numbers to my ear.
I'm going to look up the lyrics for this because I bet there's going to be some...
I feel like Kiss It For Me, Woo Woo is also a Pixies-ish...
It sounds very Pixies-ish.
Doolittle era type thing that...
You're a sex receiver and me with a big hurt. You know I had a big hurt from the very start. I'm hurting so bad because you're my roommate from hell.
Yeah. Is the verbicizer involved here? It doesn't really make much sense, does it?
I think the verbicizer might have been... Was he using the verb... No, that wasn't till the 90s. Was that till the 90s?
He probably doesn't have the verbicizer.
He's probably still using paper and scissors at this point. Got to take some blows on the stepping stones. Speak in extremes, it'll save you time. You're a saint abroad, but a devil at home. Come on here, woo-woo, and kiss it for me.
Even a glass eye and a duck's ass can see that.
I was just reading that. That's quite. I quite like that line.
But he kind of shrieks it like sort of, you know, a panicked person.
Oh, well.
You have to appreciate the swing. Sometimes.
It's
like Megalopolis. You got to just appreciate the swing. No, they tried that. He tried it.
All right, so this is him deep in his Manic Pixies phase.
I think the band actually sound really good. I think the music rips, actually.
Oh, yeah?
That and that squealing, that kind of, you know, Reeves, you know, the Sacred Squall of Now type Reeves. I'm into it. I think it rocks.
The only way I could listen to this was on YouTube because I don't actually own a physical copy of it. And by this point, my attention had started to wander a little bit because...
Fatigue.
I was getting fatigued because it's one of the problems with Tim Machine is when you need to really pay attention because otherwise it all starts to meld. And this album, more than the...
It's very Reevesian.
It's very, very Reevesian. But this isn't the worst song on the album.
Oh, no, it's by far not the worst song on the album. It's not the best. I think it's a failed experiment. It's in trying to do something like the Pixies and trying to capture the kind of the weird animus of... you know, the surreal, savage, dancing on a razor edge sort of abrasiveness and explosiveness of the Pixies, but kind of failing on that front. But as a interesting rock song, I think it's got some merits, you know. Mm. Yeah, the way that the chords kind of work, they're kind of... That's kind of cool as a punk riff. That's got legs.
And that is very Pixies.
Very Pixies. Well. Yeah. And then the kind of, you know, the hook in the chorus and the crazy guitar solos that sound like they're, I don't know, on a different song.
All right, thrashy
and chaotic. I like it.
Okay, I imagine if I had one of those bells right now, I could be ka-ding.
Yeah, this is a tick.
Give it
a green tick.
All right, there we go. It's good to have that energy because we've got something coming up now, which we need to address. I'm sorry.
I do not accept this apology.
Nor do I. You know what? When I hear the song, I imagine like the divorced guy outside his ex's house at 3 a.m, really drunk.
Oh, yeah. You know? It's pathetic.
You've summed it up. It's pathetic. Oh, and I'm just reading again on Bowie Bible. The song is an apology for hurt caused by a drug abuser. The words, "My eyes are pinned," suggests heroin.
Okay. I mean, even then, I just don't care. You know what I mean? Like, you can't even put a good backstory on this to make it better. Like, if it's about Hunt Sales, you know, getting involved in addiction, or if it's about some kind of interpersonal drama going on in the band and because Bowie's sober, that still doesn't give this song any context that makes it listenable for me.
It's a very hard listen.
It's a skip for me, and it's hard for me to skip because I only own this on vinyl, so I've got to get up and like reposition the needle.
That's how bad it is.
That's how bad it is.
I have to get up and put the needle across. It's from day one. I've just found this unlistenable, and I think
it's so bad.
Reviewers kind of latched onto this as evidence that, you know, this project is careering out of control. And I'm
the
thinking
album's
of that.
Trash. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that virulent Melody Maker article that you mentioned earlier. And this is what, you know, this would merit such vehemence. You know,
this would be the point if you were reviewing this album that you'd get pissed off with it.
Yeah.
And then write your review and be
then
like,
you would miss
damn
the
it,
gem
Bowie,
at the
we
end.
Loved you. This is shit.
It is. It's again, you wonder what was happening in the sessions here. And I think it's obviously no secret that Hunt Sales had a drug problem. Bowie was, you know, clean, sober. Yeah. He was clean and sober at this point, wasn't he?
Well, he had tattooed the Serenity Prayer at the back
of his car. Okay. So we know what direction he was looking at. And Carlos Alomar, talking to David Buckley in Strange Fascination, said...
Legend book. Best book.
That's the best book, yeah?
Shout out David Buckley.
Okay, big shout out to David Buckley. I did find out that David was very unhappy during the Tin Machine stuff. He was very happy because of the drug problem they had with one of the band members, Hans Sales. It's a terrible blow when you find one of the band members is lying to you, and more importantly, lying to himself. David was depressed because of his inability to deal with that drug problem. You know, if you get ready to do a show and one of the members is totally out of it, it's going to affect you considerably, particularly when the die is cast and you've thrown yourself in with a lot of them. What are you going to do? So things clearly were difficult, and on an emotional, spiritual, personal level, it was difficult for David, having cleaned up and having, you know, very much in the process of going through some big changes in his life, to deal with a guy who is very much struggling. And to add to that, the guy who was struggling probably wanted his songs on the album.
Yeah, he probably did.
Yeah. And it could have been, look, you know, okay, we'll put your song on the album. You know, we'll give you this space. You know, you know, we're going to help you. I don't know. I'm purely speculating here. But it could be that conversations like that happened.
Yeah. There's one thing about this that's a mystery to me. And that is that on the introduction, there's definitely strings, like there's violin and viola doing some kind of, you know, slightly esoteric, you know, perfumed sort of lines. And then there's a pan pipe that comes in.
Really?
Yeah. But there's no other instruments credited other than the band.
Yeah, I'm seeing Bowie credited for sax.
Yeah, I'm not. There's definitely
nothing else. Yeah, you're right.
Unless it was synthesizer stuff, but the strings sound real to me. They sound like they're bows.
Yeah.
Someone's either disowned it or, I don't know, or it could have been Reeves doing some weird wizardry with his guitar.
It could be. I mean, what is also crazy is that there was a different version of this. While they were touring initially in 89, they did this as like a very intense, straightforward, hard rock version. So they've actually, this song isn't just a one-off for this. They've worked it.
God, bloody hell, they've workshopped it.
They've workshopped it. Oh, hey guys, what can we do with this? What can we do with this song? Then they took it back out on the 91-92 tour.
Yeah, well, listen, this is why Bowie, as an artist working with other musicians, had to always be an authoritarian and not a democracy. Yeah. Because if you're in a band and the band decide this is what's happening, that's the only excuse. I know Bowie's quality control hasn't always been top notch, but like to let this one through the net, I feel is quite unforgivable.
I only came up with that theory about it being a way to help Hunt Sales.
Like you need this. You need this. To say yeah. Sorry. So
I'm no, not so much that, but more like we're going to help you. We're going to help you. You know, we're going to give you reasons. We're going to help give you reasons to sort yourself out. Look, we'll put your songs on the album. You know, maybe, I don't know, this is what I'm saying, pure guesswork, but maybe it was like, look, you've got some compositions. We want to help you out of a difficult situation. Let's put a couple of your songs on this, make you feel, you know, you're contributing. You're actually here. You're doing something.
You are good. Look.
Yeah, you are
good. Put your songs on.
Your song. We love your song, don't we? Yes.
Everybody.
Love it. We love it. That one's
love them.
Amazing.
They're great.
Amazing. And what was the other one you do? State. It's like Ashes to Ashes, that song. Yeah. It's Hunt's there like.
I can see it now. Yes. In the Bowie pick, in the biopic of Bowie, in the Bowie biopic, this is how it goes down.
Yeah.
And they're all, it's an intervention for Hunt. And they're like, stay alive, Hunt. Do it for your songs. Do it for your future.
Think of the kids.
Think of your kids and all the royalties you're going to get from
exactly.
Sorry.
From Sorry. But again, unfortunately, when it comes down to it, I do think of a guy just screaming outside someone's window at 3 a.m.
It is just, it's just real test. And it pains me that the quality of some of these songs on this record have to share space with this.
Yeah.
Proximity infection, you know, like they're tainted by the fact that Goodbye Mr. Red is the next song and it deserves better than that. That's one of my favorite Bowie songs. It deserves better.
But don't you think it only makes them better? because you're so relieved to get past this. Although these days, of course, we can all just skip past it. But I, when I listened to this, my phone was in a bag or something. I couldn't flick through tracks, so I was kind of stuck with it. And
when Mr. Ed starts up, you're like, thank God. From AT&T.
Someone sees it all. Goodbye, Mr. Ed, and his skull enshrined in a shopping mall in Queens. Someone sees it all. Icarus takes his pratfall, Bruegel on his head. Goodbye, Mr. Ed. 24 black kids, some of them are blind. Someone sees it all. Tolerance of violence by the fellows with no heads. Goodbye, Mr. Ed.
Isn't it just like...
It's just a, he just pulled it out of the bag, didn't he?
It could be like something on Heathen, couldn't it? You know, it's got that stunning, same poetic...
It's beautiful, it's a classic.
...mythical America of the 1950s as a substitute for an emotional place of mind, an emotional frame of mind.
I bloody love it.
That place he goes to in Slip Away.
Yeah, but on top of that, like, you know, we've sort of been talking about the quality of the songwriting on Tin Machine as a whole. It's a bit of a mixed bag.
Mm.
But... you get a song like this in Amlapura that, like, the depth goes... this is like, again, like just Bowie back to writing really good songs, like in the craft of writing songs. And it's just the way that the vocal does so much against the lyric, like the way that he's tapping into that a special poetry of late period Bowie here, like where he's like working with the performance aspect against and with the lyric to provide a prismatic experience of how to access the content of the song. He's doing it here.
Working against, sorry, with and against
the lyric. Yeah, he is, because he's got this sort of resigned, cold, absent vocal style, right? This sort of fall dog bombs the moon vocal style.
Yeah.
On exquisite lyrics that are just so evocative of emotion and like time and place and surreal banality, which again is a thing. It's unfortunate and beautiful. It's like these pictures, right? Tragic pictures. And then he just sets the poetry up. Like he just sort of simply says, someone sees it all, you know.
I was wondering about that. Who is, that keeps coming back. That's this almost like the central line in the song. Someone
It goes straight back to Baby Universal, who doesn't matter, I've seen everything anyway.
Yes.
Right? This idea that someone witnesses everything. When I was writing Black Star Theory, Goodbye Mr. Red kept coming up in the periphery of a lot of what I was looking at, like particularly Valentine's Day, who sees it all. Who is the one who sees it all, and in the show is the one that the shadow sees, witnesses everything. And this idea of, like, you know, Bruegel being brought up here, which is a real deep cut, right, from The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is, you know, referencing Thomas Jerome Newton, but not by name. It's referencing the painting that shows up in the book, which is also shows up in the film. it's just gorgeous, you know, this kind of... deep cut shadow work stuff with his own legacy that I love about the late period. This song does it. And just so beautifully as well. And I think the band are great here. You know, it would have been great to hear Morrissey's version of this. And it would be great to hear a Heathen era version of this too.
I know, this is so Heathen to me. And this is actually a Hunt and Tony co-write.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And because the bass line is doing so much here, and this is like, for me, this is like the moment where Tony really holds his own in the band, like, because that hungry bass, that restless, you know, how it kind of travels around, it doesn't sit on the root note at all. It's like reaching around for something to hang on to.
Yeah.
It brings so much it brings this kind of...
It gives it that yearning feeling. You know, yeah. That you're not rooted. It's what we were talking about earlier as well, where the whole band coalesced to exist in a state of sort of suspended...
Yeah.
Something, you know, where
it's like
you are unsettled.
When they get it, they get it. And on this song, they do. And it's as well as Hunt as well. I mean, bless him. I don't forgive him. I know he said sorry. I don't forgive him. But the drumming on this is a fantastic, like sort of controlled emotion. Like, and he bursts through and then it dies down and the tempo is like surging and waning and beautifully done. The guitar lines, the counter melody that's giving all the emotion that Bowie's voice is not giving, is just exquisite. I just love this song so much. And I can't get enough of it. Like, I listen to it and I'm like, it's just not long enough. And it's doing that same thing again with the harmonies where they're playing different chords and different bass lines. So Tony's doing other stuff, suggesting more colour that's there. And it's just Tin Machine at their peak. I mean, that this is the last song they put on wax, to me, is all right. It's a good legacy. It's one of Bowie's best songs, I think.
This album deserves to be heard by more people. I think this album needs to be revisited within the broader context of what came afterwards as holding the ideas that would be plundered for a good couple of decades. I mean, you're absolutely right. There's so much of heathen in the textures and the washes of Goodbye, Mr. Red, as well as with that. I can't get over the Manhattan metaphors.
The ghosts of Manhattan,
yes.
Shrieking
the
as they fall.
The ghosts of Manhattos, yes.
From AT&T, Someone Sees It All. Just beautiful lyrics.
Absolutely beautiful lyrics. And this is before he became so irrevocably associated with Manhattan, isn't it? I don't think he was living full-time in Manhattan by this point.
And it's a New York song.
Because, it is a very New York song.
Yeah. I mean, it's got the Andy's skull enshrined in the shopping mall in Queens.
Yeah.
And it's also got a reference to Bruegel on his head and, you know, Thomas Jerome Newton, where he ended up, which is Manhattan, which is a setting of Lazarus, you know.
Of course, yeah. You know, yeah. I miss that Bruegel reference entirely. That's
Icarus takes his pratfall is the line, which again is such a fantastic lyric. Which is all this stuff, and it links back to the, you know, there's this wonderful, I don't have my reference in front of me, there's this wonderful interview he does with Balthus in Modern Painters.
Yes, yes.
And it's a wonderful interview. It's quite odd, actually, but because he sort of is hanging around Balthus and like trying to strike up conversations, but he brings up this Bruegel painting and brings up a point about it saying, you know, I can't stop, I've never shaken this painting, isn't it just such a great image, you know, that everything just goes on. Everyday life just continues on because it has to.
Mm.
You know, fantastic things happen. Actually, I have it right here. Where is it? Yeah, I've got it here. So he says they get to talking about Bruegel's painting and Bowie reflects on how there is, quote, this tiny figure and everybody in the painting is continuing to live their lives as if nothing is happening. It's this momentous event so poignant that these monumental events that will take place in our lives, but life is totally indifferent to it all. And this idea of like indifference is a spiritual idea that links back to baby universals, links forward to heathen. Feel like with Tin Machine 2, and maybe this is why I love it so much, is that he's getting to it. He's finding the thing that he's looking for, sort of. The thing that is driving him to write music, you know, this question that he's asking, he's trying to find the answer to.
And here's where he might just begin to put a shape to it.
Feel like it. I can. That's what I'm smelling
in
this project with these songs and with these ideas. And, you know, the fact that he'd held that image of that painting by proxy almost, because he played that character in that show, you know. And when you read Walter Tevis's book, you know, it's framed by Icarus's fall, right? So it's all about Icarus falling, Icarus crashing.
Yes.
All of that. So the idea of somebody kind of crashing to the ground and it being this magical, momentous thing, but that life is indifferent. Stuff magical happens every day. Andy's skull is in a shopping mall in Queens. No one cares.
I love that line. Yeah, I absolutely love that line. It's, it's just beautiful. I'm just trying to think, what is the final track on Lou Reed's New York album, which is Dime Store Mystery? That's it.
Oh yeah,
which is so similar in spirit to this. that has been nagging at me all day and all evening. What is that track? And it's Dime Store Mystery. And it's so... I know Bowie was a big fan of Lou's.
It's got a lot of that kind of Lou poetry to
it,
doesn't it?
Exactly. And this is something that Lou was doing around... He would have... Yeah, he really kind of got back into this around 89, 88, 89, when he did the New York album. Using New York imagery and weaving in all sorts of far more existential questions into the sort of rather gritty... urban signifiers of, Manhattan.
That's great, that is, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I can feel that too. God, such a good song.
Such a good song.
It's got to get it on streaming.
We really should set up a campaign.
Let's make a label.
We'll make a label. We'll make the album-to-album label. And if you've made it this far in the episode, please feel free to send us something
to
towards
donate
this.
To our GoFundMe.
We're going to set up a GoFundMe, and who was, I saw You've Got the Reissue, so who was it who actually put it out again? How did that work?
There was a big drama about it, wasn't there? Because it was done without anyone's permission, I think.
How do you do that? I should do more things like that.
Yeah, so this is the Music on Vinyl company.
Yeah.
Under exclusive license from Victor Entertainment, Japan.
Huh.
Which is not the same name,
no.
But very similar. But,
well, Victor, whatever they're called, Victory.
Yeah.
Went bust in, what, 94?
So maybe they got through and someone thought it was a typo and realised, oh.
So Victory Records went bust in 94.
Yeah.
I think so.
Probably this record did it to them.
It must have. Can you imagine Victory Records, this tiny record label in Japan, and the
We've
guys
got Bowie record. We're
guess what, guys? You know, one minute we're putting out sort of like 7-inch singles in plastic in paper bags. Next minute, we've got Bowie. Cut to 3 years later. Well, that
bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy. And then how gutted you'd be to watch him swanning around the world promoting Black Tie White Noise.
Fuck. Oh my god.
Yeah.
That but would suck.
That all comes in the future, but for now we have this.
We have
Tin Machine 2.
We have this unusual record which has lots of interesting details to it, and I feel like Bowie really returning to the craft of songwriting and finding his feet and finding the way forward for the future here on this record.
Why do you think he ignored this album throughout his lifetime? He didn't come back to it. He made no effort to revive it. I mean, obviously one or two tracks.
Yeah, like Shopping for Girls Amlapura. No, no, he didn't do that again, did he? It was...
Again, Amlapura would have been...
That should have made a comeback.
You know, when he got his touring band together during the 2000s.
Baby Universal was the other one that had a bit of a life, yeah.
But it just seems to have been, you know, forgotten.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just the whole experience.
Maybe it was a bad vibe.
Yeah.
Maybe just got bummed out by that review and the other ones, or maybe he was just itchy to move on. Maybe that was his instinct, like keep moving, don't sink, you know, keep swimming. And he had like the prolific, he's starting to get into a purple patch here. I mean, I know critically it was received variously in different places, but he's pumping out a lot of stuff, like lots of songs, lots of ideas, concepts that, you know, even before One Outside, there was the Leon thing, all of that. That was a huge like dump of creativity, which is really exciting, you know, to see him there in that purple patch. So maybe he was just eager to get this done and, you know, the door shut behind him and to move on.
So Tin Machine served its purpose.
I guess so.
And fresh fields awaited.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Leah, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk about Tin Machine 2 with you, and you've definitely given me a completely new perspective on it. There's a lot to think about, and I very much look forward to us setting up our record label. Getting this and getting our little penis stickers ready.
Wait for the penis.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
The ghost of Manhattan's shrieking as they fall from AT&T. Someone sees it all. Goodbye, Mr. Red, and his skull enshrined in a shopping wall in Queens.
And that was Lea Cardos and I emerging from the metallic underworld of Tin Machine 2. And it's well worth your time in tracking down a copy if you don't already have one. I'm going to put some links in the program notes should you agree that you need to add a coloured vinyl copy to your collection. Thanks to Lea for her time speaking to me for these episodes. And if you're still after more Tin Machine 2, well, I have something special lined up for the next episode coming soon. But in the meantime, thank you for listening, and from me here at Album to Album HQ, goodbye for now.